Film Nerds Unlimited. Lo-fi movie conversations with high-quality movie connoisseurs. Issue 97. Ben Stark of Wondermill Films. Ben Flanagan of AL.com. Graham Flanagan of Business Insider.
It is, it's not the end of any year, but it's the end of what some consider the movie year. The Oscars are over. Everybody has seen or had somewhat of a chance to see everything they wanted to see. It's March. So it's time for us to talk about the best movies of the year that ended 3 months ago. These kind of things are always tough, and I always like to have my list done, you know, January 1st. But I'm always the first to admit that that is not a very comprehensive list, and that there's so many things that I haven't gotten to see. But I do think that, I mean, do you then feel like you've had a pretty good chance to see everything that you really, really felt like you needed to see?
I think so. At least everything I really wanted to see and everything before I really wanted to call it a year, I had to see these movies. And I did that a while back, and now I've been kind of just catching up as Oscar season has wound down, and now I'm just kind of watching a few of the stragglers. Like, I'm in the middle of Love and Mercy right now, the Brian Wilson movie. I just never caught up with it, and I found it at the public library and thought, I got to see this if I want to, you know, consider it for the list, the 2015 list. But in this conversation, Love and Mercy is just not going to make the cut, I'm afraid. I'm only halfway through it, though. But there are a handful of others that I wish I'd seen, but what we struggle with, you and I, and most of the film nerds, is we live in Alabama, you know, and we don't get the same access that, say, our friend and my brother Graham Flanagan gets, right? He lives up in New York. He has access to everything. I mean, screeners float around up in those parts, and out west, obviously, where some of our friends live. So we don't have the same kind of access, and people can go certain routes to remedy that if they want to, and you know, sometimes that's necessary. But, you know, for the most part, I like to watch movies in the theater, and I like to watch them on my big flat screen TV, you know, and that's how I tried to watch most of these movies. And so, yeah, I think my list is pretty complete. I think my top 10 is pretty ironclad. I don't foresee anything just sneaking up on me. I wouldn't rule anything out, but I feel good about my top 10.
Yeah, I think this is one of the few years where I've gotten a chance to be pretty comprehensive with everything. For me, it's the access, but it's also the time. Like, being a dad and having a job and having projects that I'm working on all over the place, it's hard to, and not being a paid film critic or a film critic of any kind, it's hard to really, you know, prioritize every single movie that I want to see. But that said, I did get to see a number of movies this year, and I actually got to see all the Oscar nominees, all the Best Picture nominees, that is, for the first time in a long time. So I felt like, you know, I had a pretty good pool to draw from. So I had a few major ones that I didn't get to see that I wish I had. There's a movie called Tokyo Tribe that I heard a lot about that I didn't get to see. I did not see Anomalisa. I didn't see Robert Zemeckis's The Walk. And there's probably a number of other movies. I heard good things about The Kingsman, that I didn't see that movie. So there's a bunch of movies that I wish I had gotten to see, but for whatever reason, and I'll probably, you know, see them someday. I mean, I'm still adding movies to my top 10 of 1947 list. So, you know, hopefully I'm going to be watching movies from 2015 forever. But yeah, are there any major ones on your list other than Love and Mercy that you kind of wanted to get to and you didn't get a chance to?
Well, yeah, I mean, what I hate about the access that we have is, you know, we have limited access to American indies, let alone foreign films, and so I often have to wait until Netflix or some other medium or other format or platform to watch the great foreign films of the year. You know, I've seen a handful of them. The one that is probably the biggest that's missing is Son of Saul, which won the Oscar, which looks phenomenal, and I really badly want to see that. So I missed it. I missed The Assassin. I missed...
That was one for me, too.
Yeah, a handful of them. So, and you mentioned Anomalisa. I did not see Anomalisa. You know, like I said, I'm in the middle of Love and Mercy right now. I miss Crimson Peak, the Guillermo del Toro movie, a movie I really wanted to see. I miss Spike Lee's new movie, Chirac, and that's in a red box near me, so I have no excuse now. So, again, there are a handful that I haven't seen, but, I mean, like you said, we're still catching up on movies that came out decades ago, and pretty soon 100 years ago, you know? So it's okay if we didn't see everything. Like you said, we don't get paid to watch these movies necessarily, and we're big film fans, and we can see what we can, and obviously we have busier lives than we used to, and you certainly had a busier year than I did, and my 2016 is probably going to mirror what you just experienced and what you will for the rest of your life, having a child now. So it's going to be a challenge, but it's one I'm ready to take on. And honestly, Ben, this is probably true for you, but I mean, having a kid around has informed this list of mine and has informed the way I watch movies now. So I've personally noticed a lot of movies here that I'm about to include that, for instance, I had a daughter in early 2016, and obviously my wife was pregnant with our daughter down the stretch of 2015, so I think it's no surprise that a big theme in my top 10 here is daughters, in fact. And we can get into it more specifically, but I just, now that I'm looking at it, it's not any sort of concerted effort that I made or anything, but I definitely trended towards stories about young female characters, and young or old, actually, but when there was an emphasis on them being the daughter of somebody and how that factored into the story and their character. So I find that really interesting. I think it's coincidence. Maybe it wasn't.
Yeah, spoilers for the top of the list there, I feel like. Well, so, I mean, what we can maybe do is we'll go through our top 10s, counting from starting at 10, and then we'll maybe wrap it up with some honorable mentions. So I guess, go ahead. What is your number 10 movie of 2015?
Number 10, and look, number 10 and number 11 were really close for me. And we'll get into honorable mentions later, but I just want to give a quick shout-out to my number 11. It's Cobain, Montage of Heck, one of the documentaries I saw last year from Brett Morgan, which I tried to be as honest as I could with this list, and that the 10 movies that I formed, you know, this list that I formed here, it's all about just the totally visceral and emotional experiences and impact that those movies had on me. And this documentary I saw a while back was really special, I thought. It's just a beautifully drawn together just mosaic of art, and it's one of the few movies that I think really gets inside the head of an artist, where you just touch that raw nerve of what was going on inside the head of somebody like Cobain. And you know, I was a huge fan of Nirvana, and so that played a big part in it too. So not to spend too much time on it, but Cobain, Montage of Heck just missed my top 10. So number 10 for me is just hit me like a ton of bricks, just whack me over the head with emotion from Pixar. I think everybody knows what I'm talking about. The Good Dinosaur. This Pixar movie that nobody seemed to appreciate in 2015. I don't get it personally. I mean, it just seemed to be brushed aside because perhaps there was another Pixar that everybody focused their attention on and lavished with praise, and they thought, okay, that's it for Pixar, moving on to the rest of the movie world. Good Dinosaur came out around Thanksgiving, and it went largely ignored. I mean, it made a little bit of money, but certainly not what Pixar is used to. And it just blew my mind that so few people really seem to appreciate the simplicity of the story, but just the level of visual storytelling going on in this movie, and the same amount of emotional connection that I think exists between the audience and these characters, and such a fun set of characters to really root for. It's just a beautifully designed movie and just a beautifully told story, and just a really, truly incredible journey that these characters take, and there are just a handful of scenes that just knocked me out solid between, obviously, this lead character, the dinosaur, and this little boy that he connects with along the way when they tell their stories to each other in the sand on the bank of a river. It's just phenomenal filmmaking and storytelling, and I just wish people would either give this a second look or a first look, because I feel like a lot of people dismiss this for some reason. Like, this was, like, Pixar was above this for whatever reason. I felt the same way with Brave a few years ago, which I think is just an unheralded masterpiece from Pixar, and to me, this is the same. I walked out of this thinking, this is another Pixar masterpiece, and I wish people would give The Good Dinosaur its due. It is due. It's a phenomenal movie.
Yeah, and it is simple, but it's simple in the way that Mad Max Fury Road or Apocalypto or something like that is simple, you know, where it's like, well, the story isn't necessarily anything we haven't seen before, but the things that it communicates within that are deceptively simple. One of my favorite things about that movie is that the villain of the movie is the weather, basically, and it's just this, literally these gray clouds hanging over the whole movie. There's a lot of similarities to The Revenant, you know, where it's kind of nature being the greatest antagonist in this character's life. Yeah, I really like the Good Dinosaur a whole lot, and I agree with you. I feel like it should have gotten way more praise and money than it got. But you know what? My daughter plays with an Arlo action figure, so, you know, well, I'm doing my part. Like you said, the number 10 spot is really tough. I have three movies that are kind of like cycling in and out. So I'll do what you did, and I'll cheat and say my number 11. And I'll just go ahead and throw it out there that it's kind of a tie. I wish I had gotten more independent movies on my top 10. I think they're all studio films. If I had a number 11, it would probably be Rodney Asher's The Nightmare, which is this amazing horror documentary, basically, about people that suffer from sleep paralysis. It's some of the best filmmaking of the year, and just even me saying this makes me want to maybe make it my number 10. But for now, it's my number 11, and while I'm mentioning documentaries, I also have to mention two documentaries that I saw at the Sidewalk Film Festival. The Oppenheimer's The Look of Silence, which is phenomenal and haunting, and also Finders Keepers, about a guy who gets in a feud with another guy about his own severed leg. It's fantastic if people get a chance to see that. I think it's going to be hitting most distribution channels this year. So those are my numbers 11. But my number 10, like I said, this just kind of swept in as I thought about it more and more. It's a movie I didn't get a chance to see until fairly recently. It's a Danny Boyle movie, and I think it might be my favorite Danny Boyle movie, Steve Jobs. Really incredible Aaron Sorkin script that has this really unique structure that I don't think anybody except for Sorkin would have, you know, come across. Amazing performances, high drama, an incredible score, and just beautiful, slick direction by Danny Boyle. Everybody's on their A game, and it's a movie that I keep thinking about. There's so many huge seminal lines. The main one being "I'm poorly made," this haunting kind of moment from Michael Fassbender. It's a great movie. I feel like it's kind of like undersung. Obviously, it didn't perform well at the box office, but everybody that I talk to about it seems to be, you know, it seems to be kind of gaining a little bit of steam in terms of regard. But yeah, so my number 10 is Danny Boyle, Steve Jobs.
My number 9 is Danny Boyle, Steve Jobs.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, we can just keep going here because I love that movie. I haven't, to be fair here to this movie, I haven't stopped really thinking about it since I saw it back in October or November or whenever it was. This is a movie that has just really stuck with me. And most of the credit is probably due to, like you said, Aaron Sorkin, who just wrote a breathless script and just what a structure that really, really took me by surprise. I did not expect it to be a three-act chamber play, essentially,
yep.
where you this is what's so weird is that there are all these questions about why did Steve Jobs fail this movie. But I think Graham shared in our text thread the other day that this movie made less money than the Ashton Kutcher Jobs movie, which is hard to believe, but I think it has a lot to do with the way this movie was marketed. And I'm sure that those were grueling meetings, you know, to have in terms of how do we market this movie, because the way they did it was, I mean, this is an art film disguised as a mainstream Hollywood movie. And I obviously, you know, that's a different story. The movie unto itself, to me, I think is brilliant. Again, the just feverish pace of not only the script, but Danny Boyle's direction. I mean, I went into it sort of unfairly thinking, what if David Fincher had directed this movie and sort of used that against it in a way, just because of how much I love The Social Network and how, you know, the fact that Fincher was attached to this movie for a long time. But Boyle really shines, and the marriage is almost equally as good. And
well,
the performances.
I mean, you mentioned shine. I mean, can you imagine Fincher designing an Apple store? No, but you can totally imagine Danny Boyle designing an Apple store. I feel like his sensibilities go hand in hand with the material.
Yeah, it's just it's beautifully made, and the performances. I mean, Fassbender is phenomenal. Kate Winslet is great. Jeff Daniels is great. Michael Stuhlbarg, fantastic. The different young women who play Steve Jobs' quote-unquote illegitimate daughter in this movie. And again, we go back to that theme of daughters. This is the first movie that winds up on the list in terms of that theme in the first scene, the first act, I should say, because like this movie really flies by. I mean,
yeah,
the three-act structure really helps it in doing that, but the first sequence when he's about to introduce the what is it, the Apple II or which the Macintosh is the sequence where he lets his daughter, or you know, someone he denies being his daughter, draw a picture on his new computer is just, you know, I don't want to go into too great a detail here because that moment really just gut checked me, you know, when I saw it. And then obviously there is, you know, a nice bookend in the movie where they come back to it after a really big, you know, emotional scene with a lot of dialogue. And then Danny Boyle uses that moment from the beginning to tell something non-verbally in a way that just really blew me away and really works. And then there's a really quiet scene on a rooftop right after that moment right before that moment. I think that is
right.
Also really just great between a father and a daughter. And I just love how they broke it down so simply in trying to tell the story of this legend of technology and industry. And, I mean, this has great editing going back and forth, present day to flashback. I think it does a great job of capturing period design. Seth Rogen is another great performance in this movie. So
yeah.
this it just has everything working for it. And for whatever reason, again, I haven't really stopped thinking about Steve Jobs. I've only seen it the one time. I can't wait to see it again.
I mean, all credit to you. You before I'd seen it, you recommended I listen to some of the soundtrack,
and
I liked it at first. But then when I saw it utilized in the movie, I have not stopped listening to Daniel Pemberton's score. And there's particularly this one track that is called Revenge that plays underneath this long non-linear sequence where they're kind of recounting his ousting from Apple. And,
oh yeah,
and it's just like, oh man, it's just masterful filmmaking from every perspective. And it's a movie that, you know, the more I watch it, it may climb up this list, you know, as the years go by.
Yeah, and that second sequence that you're talking about there, there's a big scene between him and Jeff Daniels that you're talking about there.
Yep.
And then there's a big scene between him and Seth Rogen. That whole second act where he's introducing the next machine is probably the strongest act of the movie, just the best piece of filmmaking from Danny Boyle there. And the soundtrack, like you mentioned, should be just anointed from 2015. It's phenomenal. My favorite track is the Skylab Plan, which is great, played during that sequence too. So everybody should watch Steve Jobs.
Yeah, and the Skylab monologue that he gives too is just wonderfully visually underlined by Danny Boyle. Seems like we can just keep talking about this forever. But so my number nine is Lenny Abrahamson's Room, which, you know, speaking, we keep talking about parenting, and dear Lord, is this movie hard to watch for anybody, let alone a parent? Yeah, it's gripping. It's counterintuitive in the way, that the direction that the script goes. And it's really mature in the way that it pays things off. It seems like an idea that could be easily exploitative and kind of tawdry. But it's treated so delicately, that it's respectful of its subject matter. You know, I mean, it deals with rape and kidnapping and unwanted pregnancy and all these things that are serious topics. But it never does that in an exploitative way to get a rise out of the audience. It just deals with it organically, and lets the story unfold. And has this, you know, you would think that the most compelling part of the movie is its first half, when it's, kind of sequestered into a single location. But really, once the movie opens up, it so many more dimensions, come into play that it just keeps surprising you throughout. Abrahamson was, when I watched the trailers and stuff, it just kind of seemed like, I don't know, the typical kind of handheld indie filmmaker style. But then when I watched the movie, the way he used perspective, from the character of, played by Jacob Tremblay, is, phenomenal. And it's what movies are all about, you know, is putting the audience in the shoes of a character that there's no way they can know. So obviously the performances are great. Brie Larson won an Oscar. Tremblay should have been nominated, I think. And Abrahamson, of course, was nominated too. So it's a fantastic movie. I'm glad. It's a movie I feel like that could have easily been overlooked because it didn't have, you know, any huge things about it in terms of awards. So I'm glad it got as much recognition as it did, because if it hadn't, I may not have checked it out. So it's an example of why the awards season is sometimes kind of good, because it urged me to watch something I may not have sought out otherwise.
Great pick for sure. And Abrahamson isn't a guy to keep an eye on. And you're right about point of view and perspective. And I just love the way he tells it from the boy's perspective. And it's a really intense movie too, especially that first half, or at least how they transition from one half to the next. So yeah, great pick. My number eight is also a movie about parenting. It's Neil Blomkamp's Chappie, which it was the first movie of 2015 that I really loved. And I can't remember when it came out, like February or March or whenever that was, but it made me want to get up and cheer when I saw it, because Blomkamp is a guy whose work I think has gotten better progressively with each movie. And I know that for many, that's blasphemy, considering the legion of fans that District 9 has, and most would say the opposite has happened, that his movies have gotten worse. I don't understand that. I think Chappie is one of the most vibrant, exciting, funny, just downright thrilling sci-fi movies that I've seen in a long time, and that includes the rest of his filmography, all of which I think are great movies. But to me, this is just the most personal story he's told so far, in that it teaches you, again, I mean, there are several movies, again, like Ex Machina, which is a really terrific movie from 2015, but movies that really sort of, they ask the very basic question, what makes us human beings? And, you know, what is the real difference between machine and human? And, you know, you have this character, Chappie, that represents, I mean, in ways, I think pet owners could see it like an animal, like a puppy dog, but I think parents probably see it for what I think Blomkamp intended it to be, like a little child, and how this, you can't, I think one of the themes that it kind of explores is you can't control who your parents are. That's just out of your control. And Chappie happens to be born to these adopted by these inner city South African gangster characters played by this South African hip hop group D Antwoord, a just discovery that I know I made in 2015, and they're an actual hip-hop group who play very loose versions of themselves here, and Chappie's adoptive parents who use this once a police drone robot to their advantage to pull off heists and other crimes so they can get back good with the big crime overlord that they serve and want to be a part of. So I just think that Charlto Copley's motion capture performance and vocal work is terrific. He keeps doing just outstanding work with Blomkamp, but this movie just has so many sweet moments and turns into such a great crowd pleaser, but at the same time has some of the best action of 2015, and it reiterates the fact that Blomkamp is one of the best action directors working today. I hope he stays in the realm. People keep saying he makes the same movie over and over. I totally disagree. I think Chappie is a wholly original vision that really, to me, propels him as one of the fresh voices in filmmaking today. And so I want more from Neil Blomkamp. And Chappie is one of the most underrated movies of the year and one people should give a real shot.
Yeah, I mean, as time passes, I'm afraid I kind of fall into the mass consensus on Chappie. I don't think it's the terrible movie that people call it, but it just didn't stick with me. And I think part of it is because of the Antwoord. It just didn't work for me. But I mean, I do think it's interesting how you and Tess have modeled your parenting after them, to the point that, I mean, the haircut, you know, I think you're making it work. You're making it work. So my number eight is Mission Impossible Rogue Nation. That's a movie that you and I actually reviewed on Film Nerds Unlimited, back when it came out. So I'm not going to say a whole lot about it other than it's awesome. It's a great example of what action movies should be, especially on budgets as big as the one it has. The script kind of, I mean, Christopher McQuarrie is very transparent about the script being, you know, kind of made up as they went along. And, I feel like some of that shows, but, regardless, it still works because of his direction, because of Tom Cruise's, performance and abilities, and of course because of Rebecca Ferguson's kind of breakout performance. So Mission Impossible Rogue Nation is my number eight.
That's a great pick. It's just outside my top 10. It's like number 12 or so. Really, really good. So yeah, I can't wait to see it again. So I have several movies that obviously fall ahead of this movie on this top 10 list, but I will always remember 2015 as the year that Star Wars The Force Awakens came out. And I just think I'd be a fool to leave it off of my top 10 of the year. I don't know how much of my expectations and anticipation goes into this pick, but I just really feel like it delivered on so many levels, if not all of them. And the level of reverence and respect that J.J. Abrams used or treated this movie with as he made it and gave this franchise back to the fans in such an just tender way, in a way, for lack of a better term. It was just a wonderful experience. And, you know, I saw this with my family a few days after it came out, so it took me a few days to see it. I managed to avoid all of the huge spoilers that obviously exist within it, but It brought Star Wars back to us, and it belongs on the list for that reason alone. But I mean, just in terms of the story itself, I love the story. I love the new characters, especially the big three that are obviously introduced here: Kylo Ren and Finn and Rey. Those actors just get the job done. They're great, and I think that they create an emotional connection that was obviously lacking from, obviously, those prequel movies. It was just good to have Star Wars back and to revisit those old characters like Han Solo and Chewie and Princess Leia and others, and just for Abrams to create from scratch in a way, even though, I mean, he has a huge mythology from which he can build. But in a way, I mean, he creates something so incredibly new. And again, it starts with the characters and it starts with the story, and that's the emphasis that he obviously wanted to put on this experience, and that is what was lacking for so long with this franchise. And I just have nothing but appreciation for a guy like J.J. Abrams. And you know, look, even if this falls short of Avatar and J.J. Abrams will never be a master, it for me is just one of the absolute pure cinematic experiences of 2015, and I will never forget it.
Yeah, that may come up again later. So I won't comment anymore. My number seven is Noah Baumbach's While We're Young. This is a movie that I watched. I thought, well, you know, this is this little comedy. It's been a while since I've seen a Baumbach movie. It was on Amazon Prime or something. So I was like, all right, well, let me watch a bit of it at lunch or something like that by myself at work. So I put it on the laptop, started, and within 2 minutes, I turned it off, and I was like, I have to watch this movie with my wife on our TV. This movie needs my full attention. It does not need to be an afterthought. And sure enough, that night we watched it together and had a fantastic time. This is a hilarious movie that touches on so many neuroses that I think all of us have as we get into our 30s and realize that we're not young. Even if we were never cool, that we're even further away from being cool than we ever were. The modern frustrations of generational divides, but also of being somebody that wants to create for a living and doesn't always get taken very seriously as that. There's obviously a lot of personal stuff in this movie. And yet it doesn't just rest on its laurels to be a situational comedy. It also has a number of kind of big things to say about truth and subjectivity. And some people would say it's delivered in kind of an on the nose way, but I think that that's okay. I think that it's the characters, you know, dodging something for a whole movie and then having to confront each other. And there's great performances from Naomi Watts and Ben Stiller and Adam Driver, of course. While We're Young is a movie I that really blew me away. I do wish I had seen Mistress America. That's another one I wish I had seen. I've heard great things about that. It's kind of like when Wes Anderson has a movie and it's like, oh, right. Yeah, this guy's amazing. And I don't need to forget that. It's the same thing with Noah Baumbach. It's like this guy, we should be very appreciative of how special he is. And it's a big deal when he has a new movie. And it's definitely made me, you know, go back and up the priority on checking out his movies that I haven't seen yet. So while we're Young is my number seven.
That's my number 15, and I've seen both of the Baumbach movies from last year, and I think While We're Young is the better movie. I prefer it. I think it just has so much more real to say about human beings and obviously parenthood and that next step that you inevitably take in your life in terms of facing your age and accepting that and your shortcomings and in terms of your profession, in terms of your relationships. It's a really great pick. It has my favorite line of 2015, and it's said by Adam Horowitz, who everybody obviously knows is Ad Rock from the Beastie Boys, a guy I didn't realize was even in the movie until shortly before I saw it. And the line he has, he's a new parent, and he's talking to Ben Stiller about parenthood and having kids. And he says, I love my kid, but I'm still the most important person in my life.
Yeah.
But that was just a bizarre thought and line for someone to say, a young parent especially, and it sheds a lot of light on how certain people might feel about being a parent, how they're not ready to do that. And what's coming to them and how it's hopefully going to hit them that is not the case.
I think that's why it's a great movie, is that there's actually a discussion to be had there. Because I think there's part of us that we probably want the kid to be the most important thing, because that's
right.
It probably should be, but that's not how it is. You know, it's
right.
Like,
you don't just flip a switch.
Exactly. Especially as a father, I think a lot of times we're like, oh, right. it ties back to something, a line from Francis Ha, which is a movie that didn't blow me away, but it has this one line in there that I always talk about, with Danielle when we're just talking about parenting and we're talking about other people's parenting. She says something like, you know, everybody's talking about their kids at this dinner table. She's at a dinner party. And she says something like, you know, if you have a kid and all you talk about is your kid, but your kid is an extension of yourself, doesn't that make you just as narcissistic as if you're talking about yourself all the time? And it's like, yeah, exactly. And it's, I don't know. I feel like I think he has a really great perspective on parenting and keeping, you know, keeping your head on straight when you're a parent and how you present yourself to the world. When all you talk about is your kid, you know, you're basically just talking about yourself, and you're more selfish than you realize you are, even though you're giving up so much of yourself to your child.
For sure. He's brilliant. He really, and he just keeps making brilliant movies. So you're right that it's a big deal whenever there's a new Noah Baumbach movie, and there were two last year. So God, we were spoiled.
Yep.
But yes, see Mistress America soon. It's good. My number six, and I feel like half of my list are movies I would pick to be the most underrated movies of the year. But it's David O. Russell's Joy, which I walked out of that just elated and thinking I'd seen maybe David O. Russell's best movie. And then I see this response, this collective response from people that mirrors what you and I talked about with The Revenant, that there's just sort of this faction of people who just seem to choose not to like it or to want to like it before they even saw it, and they just went with that without considering just the vibrancy that this movie brings in terms of David O. Russell as a storyteller, who I think has really evolved ever since he even made his comeback with The Fighter in telling what I think is just a fantastic, crowd-pleasing story about this self-made woman who will just furiously attack the American dream no matter what obstacle happens to be in her way. I think it's Jennifer Lawrence's best performance to date, certainly her best in a David O. Russell movie. And to me, it just worked on all cylinders. All of the performances are great. The story is so worth rooting for. I was so invested from the word go. And for me, it's just watching the work of an exciting filmmaker. That's what I walked out of it saying, or what I thought while I was watching. This is exciting filmmaking. This is just moving at a pace that few other filmmakers are working at. And I mean, obviously he draws from people like Scorsese, and that seems to be, you know, a director that he at times tries to emulate in movies like The Fighter and Silver Linings Playbook and American Hustle. To me, Joy is sort of the culmination of what David O. Russell has been trying to be that whole time. I think it trimmed a lot of the fat off of what existed in the three movies that preceded it. And to me, this was his most focused storytelling to date. And I don't know. I just really found myself in a good mood when I was watching it and when I was walking out of that theater. And I won't let other people's negative experience affect my positive one, but I certainly don't understand it, because if you love those three movies that came before it, I just don't understand why you don't love Joy.
Yeah, well, it's just, it's over. The time to like David O. Russell and Jennifer Lawrence, it's over. You know, there was the proper time to enjoy their work, and now that time is over, so get with the times.
Yeah, I
agree with you. It's a really magical movie. It's right up there with those other films that you mentioned, and it's this great picture of this person going up against the system, you know, and it illustrates so well how suffocating that system is, you know, and trying to be a capitalist. It is so difficult. Not because of capitalism in of itself, but because of the structures that have established themselves over the decades and the centuries. And it illustrates that, but then it also tells a very human story, and it's reminiscent of something like Tucker, A Man and His Dream from Francis Ford Coppola, I think. And it's a really inspirational and fun and vibrant movie. And definitely more people should see it and consider it. My number six is Denny Villeneuve's Sicario, which is Craig and I talked about it on Film Nerds Unlimited. It's fantastic. It's a movie that, you know, still the way that the score kind of pounds through the whole movie and just kind of lingers through the whole movie. That's how the movie lingers in my brain. It's just like this pulsing rhythm in the back of my head that I kind of keep going back to and thinking about and mulling over. It's this incredible procedural, but it's also, in a way, a tone poem. It's some of the best cinematography of the year that is totally tied into the themes and the character arc of the film. Incredible performance, I think, from Emily Blunt. I know a lot of people consider it almost a non-performance, but I think that there's a Michael Mann quality to her performance and to the whole movie, really. And it's really great. And it's just high level filmmaking that makes you think and makes you uncomfortable and makes you consider how awful the world is. So Sicario is my number 6.
Great pick, just outside my top 10. Really fun experience, and you know, the one thing that really doesn't work for me about this movie is the Emily Blunt performance, and I love Emily Blunt. I mean, I'm a big fan. She's a big reason I really wanted to see this movie, and perhaps it's the character more so than the performance, but yeah, for whatever reason, that's kind of what I really like the movie a lot. So I won't say it's like it's what prevented it from getting over the hump, but it's just the one thing I found lacking, and I think had that element been nailed the way the rest of the movie was, then it would have been in the hunt for the top spot on my list, probably. So,
well, I mean, it's such a fun movie, so, you know, just pop it in anytime, you know, make some cotton candy and enjoy it. And
it is a fun movie. Look, if you're adrenaline equals fun for me when I'm watching movies.
Right, yeah. And also filmmaking, just from a film perspective, that is it's a gleeful movie to watch. But if you consider the subject matter, I think it's quite possibly the darkest movie of the year.
No, but, you know, again, to use the word fun, everybody talks about Benicio del Toro's performance, and it deserves the recognition. It should have gotten an Oscar nomination, probably, but to me, equally good in the movie is Josh Brolin, who is really fun in this movie, and it's one of his best performance. I mean, the guy has just sheer charisma that is just on display perhaps more than ever in this movie, and is really, it's up there with some of his best work for sure. So that's a great pick. My number 5, and I love my top 5, I really do, I'm very pleased with it, is Alejandro González Iñárritu's The Revenant. And we've covered this ground before, but again, like with Joy, the animosity that exists towards this movie really existed towards this movie before it even came out.
Yep.
Blows me away. And this movie is just sumptuously filmed, and it's just such, again, it's a harsh survival adventure that explores the brutality of man in nature. And the characters are miserable, from what we're told. The actors went through a miserable experience, and the crew went through a miserable experience, obviously filmed in difficult conditions. But I think that the aim was true there in terms of their intentions of telling this very specific story and doing it as accurately as they could in terms of realizing the conditions that people like this actually lived through and survived, and also didn't survive in an age that was not kind to people, in a land that was not kind to people. And this movie, to me, while, you know, it explores the themes that I just mentioned, but also it's about family. It's about, again, survival. It's about how, in many ways, the past is hell. And I think that instead of looking backwards, this movie is all about looking forward. And despite the just difficult elements that this movie certainly brings to the table, I consider it a largely positive and powerful experience about a man who faced impossible odds, and I found myself rooting him through and hoping he made it to the end. I saw the light at the end of the tunnel with this movie, and it became an adventure. And that's what I would classify this movie as, just a pure, unadulterated adventure. And luckily, there's a character that is really worth rooting for. And, you know, I hoped that he would, you know, reach his goal, you know, and whether or not people see that as nasty, I saw it as just, and I thought that his, again, his goal and his intentions were worthy of what he went through, and it was all about honoring his family and his past and seeking a better life for himself to, in honor of those people. And I think that, you know, speaks volumes about a story that Inuyuritsu really wanted to tell. And obviously you have just the staggering scenery and Emmanuel Lubezki's just eye-popping cinematography, which is just arguably his best work to date, if you can believe that. So The Revenant, for me, it works on all cylinders, and I don't even want to give the other side of it the time of day, to be honest with you, because I just see this as a great film that should be appreciated. I'm glad I got nominated for all the Oscars. I'm glad Inuyuritsu won Best Director. This is a great movie.
Yeah, and it is. And it definitely spent a little bit of time in my top 10 before it, before some other of these muscled it out, unfortunately. But yeah, and it's such a well-crafted movie from every level, and people, you know, can poo-poo it and call it shallow and say it's just about revenge. But as you said, it's even if that is all it's about, it's pretty good at that. But I think it's about a lot more than that. And I think that the last, not even the last shot, but the last things we hear in the movie tell us a lot about thematically what the film is going for. And that last shot, as much as it in a way bothers me, I feel like if nothing else, it opens the film to another conversation you weren't planning on having about it until that shot happened. You know, it kind of recontextualizes the whole movie. And I feel like that's all we ask for from our great filmmakers, is to give us something to talk about. I agree with you. It's a shame that, you know, filmmakers work hard to give us something to talk about, and all we do is say, well, that's stupid, or that's dumb, or that's whatever, it's bloated, and then move on. It's really disingenuous, and it's like we talked about, we ranted about this already, but I think it's disrespectful to the craft as a whole. So yeah, great pick. So yeah, so we're in our top five. This is a movie that you mentioned already. It's my number five, and from now on, all of these movies might as well be considered 10 out of 10s for me, depending on how I feel and if I might watch them again. That may change. But from now on, it's these are all movies that, when we were in college, your brother Graham said something interesting about Kill Bill Volume 1 after he saw that. He said one of the ways that he decides what his favorite movie of all time is to think about what movie he wants to watch right that moment, you know, the most amount of times. And he, at that moment, it was Kill Bill. So he said, well, that must be one of my favorite movies, because I there's no movie I'd rather watch than that movie right now. And I think that's a really neat way to look at movies. And since I saw it in the theater, Star Wars The Force Awakens, it's just a movie that I can see a shot or a still or a GIF or hear a note from the score from that movie, and I just want to sit and watch the whole thing again. And unfortunately, I've only seen it once. And, you know, that's why I haven't gone the whole hog on the 10 out of 10, A-plus kind of thing on it yet, because I do need to watch it again a little bit more sober-minded. But this is a movie that's hard to watch with a sober mind, because it's so rad. You know, it's so much fun on every level. And it's a movie I wish, again, I wish I could hang up right now and just go watch that instead of talking to you. It's a wonderful movie. It's infectious, and I think it's really well crafted. I know there's a lot of criticism leveled against it about, you know, the parallels to the 1977 movie, but I think all of those are rooted in the movie itself. You know, with this Empire adjacent organization wanting to reclaim this glory that they're not able to reclaim. I think there's a metatextual, you know, level to that, and I think that it's worth talking about outside of the movie, but I think it works inside of the movie, and there's just so many great moments, and like you said, the new cast is better than the old cast, and I think that's a testament to J.J. Abrams that, yes, he gave us the throwback stuff, and some people say that's all he gave us, but which I would highly disagree with, because if you look at the best stuff in that movie, it's the stuff that he uniquely brought to the movie. You know, it's the way he shot the scenes, it's the way he frames the action, which is some of the best action of the year, and it's the way that he has these characters interact with each other while stuff is going on around them. And it's just such fun popcorn blockbuster filmmaking. It's one of the most, you know, vivid and entertaining blockbuster movies I've seen since like The Avengers or something like that. It probably tops The Avengers. It's a movie that, again, it's just pure candy, and, you know, in a year that gives you Sicario and The Look of Silence and movies like In Room and movies like that, it's okay to have a little bit of popcorn every now and then, and well-crafted popcorn is well-crafted popcorn. So that's my number five, Star Wars The Force Awakens.
So I want to pitch you like we're in a Hollywood executive's office or something like that, okay, on my number three. So
you're number four, right?
I thought I was on number three. Am I on number four?
No, I just did my number five.
Oh, number four. That's right. You're right. You're number four. So this is my number four.
Okay.
So we start the pitch here. Could I interest you in a Steven Spielberg-directed Cold War thriller that teaches us what it means to be an American and stands as one of the more politically relevant films of 2015, even though it takes place in the 1950s, featuring a career top five Tom Hanks performance that nobody seems to care about all year long? Could I interest you in that? A great Steven Spielberg Cold War thriller with a top five Tom Hanks performance. Does that sound interesting to you?
You know, I don't see a lot of money here.
Well, apparently America didn't either when Bridge of Spies came out last year. And it just, look, what is going on with...
With
people that... I mean, look, is Steven Spielberg not still Steven Spielberg? I mean, is it not cool to say Steven Spielberg movies are awesome when they're awesome if they came out after 1993? I just don't get it. Bridge of Spies is a great film, and it's my number four. And, again, I go back to the Tom Hanks thing, he has just never been better than he is in Bridge of Spies as this guy, Jeffrey Donovan, this lawyer who is tasked with representing what could be a Russian spy during the Cold War. I mean, that premise alone is phenomenal. But where it goes from there, for me, is what separates this from so many other movies in 2015, especially, again, what this Donovan character obviously represents in terms of the best parts of America and how it's important to him that being an American and upholding those values on which the country was founded and on which the country constantly brags until their feet are held to the fire and they're faced with, you know, they're put in a position where they can make the easy decision to just, you know, lynch somebody just because they are acting on their emotions, right, and acting on surface level behavior and ideas and values and you know, without remembering that document that they created so many years ago called the U.S. Constitution. And this guy, this Donovan character, again, embodied by Hanks and just brilliantly, he's just the walking embodiment of what, you know, we hope to be. And while he might see himself as a failure in some regards, he's just sort of what idealism in this country is all about. And obviously he goes head to head with this counterpart who seems to uphold the same values from where he comes from. Obviously Russia, played by Mark Rylance in an Oscar winning performance, thank goodness, because he is equally as good, somebody who was, again, tasked with you know, co-starring in a Steven Spielberg movie, starring one of the biggest movie stars of all time in Tom Hanks, and he manages to steal the movie at times. This, to me, just is the movie that made you think in 2015 about, you know, where you live, especially if you're an American. Hopefully it does that. And the fact that Spielberg is able to sort of reach into that bag of tricks and challenge himself thematically at this point in his career, you know, with a movie like this, if you go back to 2012, a movie like Lincoln, which asks many similar questions, I didn't think that Spielberg would be making great movies about America at this point in his career, and shame on me for doubting him. And he is just in as true a form as ever, and this movie has a great script, great performances, and is one of the best movies about America that I've seen in a long time.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many things that I could, so many directions I could go. You're absolutely right across the board. And I guess, yeah, I mean, speaking to the thing you were saying about, you know, I guess it's just not cool to admit when Spielberg is on point. And I would argue that he's on point so much of the time. And yeah, I guess it's just people are ready for him to die, I guess. I don't know. I don't know what the problem is, because even if you think the subject matter is boring, which is, are you 12? If that's what you're, if this is boring to you, even if you think it's about, you know, white guys in rooms talking, well, that's fine, but maybe pay attention to what they're talking about and see how that's relevant. But even if, you know, if whatever surface level, you know, things rub you the wrong way about the film, once you sit down and watch it, if you're not able to look at Bridge of Spies and see a master craftsman making a movie in terms of shots and blocking and sound design, you don't know anything about movies. I'll just go ahead and just say that. It's going to come up again later, so I should probably settle down. But, yeah, you're right. It's great, and I'm glad it's on your list. I'm glad it's in your top five.
Well, and it's just a shame that we just live in an age where it's more fun in the moment to crack a joke about how dads would like this movie, and this is a dad movie. And then once we've made that joke, we've moved on from it without
really
considering it and thinking about it and actually acknowledging, wait, no, yeah, okay, dads may like it, but it's also a great Steven Spielberg movie, and I remember when that mattered, and it still matters to me.
Yeah, dads like Unforgiven, y'all. Okay, so we're on our number four, and this is one that's kind of flopped around all over the place. It spent some time a little bit higher. Honestly, it's on my written down list here. One step higher, but the other movies, it every time I think about it, it has to stay where it is. So my number four is a movie that I watched in the theater, and it didn't quite, you know, stick with me for whatever reason, probably because it was late and I was tired, and it's a very demanding movie visually. But then I watched it on Blu-ray with my wife last week, and then watched it again immediately. It's Mad Max Fury Road. It's a masterpiece of action. It is maybe a touch too long for whatever reason. I don't know what they could have cut out, but, you know, it's really, I have to work really, really hard to think of anything I don't like about this movie because, once I really sat and tuned in and got into its wavelength, and it's hard to deny that this is one of the most memorable and deservedly most talked about movies of 2015. It's also just an action classic. It's the way it sets up character with action, the way it conveys information with action. It's everything that we ask for. The stunts are incredible. Yes, there's more CGI than the marketing may have led us to believe. But it's all used very well, and it's all in this kind of freakishly colorful fantasy land. It's a great movie. It's got guys jumping over a truck on dirt bikes, dropping Molotov cocktails onto the truck while they're getting shot at by Tom Hardy and Charlize Theron with one arm. It's got everything. It's great. It's Mad Max Fury Road.
Man, I hear everything you're saying, and I saw everything that you're just describing, but you know, and I've only seen it the one time and in bits and pieces on HBO now that it plays around the clock, but when I see it, and even when I watch it now, there's just sort of like, I just have kind of an empty feeling about it. I don't know what it is. Like, again, I acknowledge everything you say about that as being true, and all of those things that you said happened, and they're right there, but I don't know what it is about Mad Max Fury Road that just doesn't click with me.
I can't help you. Yeah. I mean, I will say that, again, when I watched it, it was late. It was late for me. It started at 8 o'clock. So once I got halfway through the movie, it kind of, my attention span waned, and it was just so much input that I think my brain just kind of quit receiving the signal. But I mean, like you said, you've watched in a few different settings. So, yeah, I don't know. It's just a movie that, once it clicked for me, it clicked, and I there was no way for me to consider it, other than the way I do, which is just as this absolute masterpiece. I mean, I think part of it that really got to me was I realized I was taking for granted the tremendous amount of imagination on display in every single shot and every single design, and that's something that you've admitted in your conversation with Craig, so I don't think I'd be telling you anything you don't already know. But yeah, it's just such a vibrant movie. It's so, obviously it's not original because it's the fourth movie in a franchise, but it's a great example of how franchise filmmaking can be very original and give us filmmaking that we can't see anywhere else.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely. You will have never seen anything like this movie, and that's as high a compliment as you can pay sometimes to, you know, the craft. So, yeah, I can't wait. I really can't wait to watch it again, and I hope I come around more than I already have. So, my number three is John Crowley's Brooklyn, which is just a beautifully told, heartwarming immigration story that, for me, just hits all the right notes. It's got likable characters. It's got sumptuous period design. And just a really elegant story worth rooting for. And Saoirse Ronan just deserves all the credit in the world for just understatedly playing this young Irish woman seeking a brighter future in New York in the 1950s, coming from Ireland, where she falls for an Italian-American man before family emergency sends her back home and challenges their newly blossomed romance. I mean, that's the log line for it. I'm not going to give anything away when it comes to this movie, if you haven't seen it. If I could recommend one movie from 2015 to absolutely anybody, any type of moviegoer, it is Brooklyn, hands down. It's just one of my favorite experiences that again, caught me off guard. I mean, I knew that people love this movie. It has like a 99% rating on Rotten Tomatoes, and while on paper it might not seem like something like, say, a grown man would want to see at the movies, when you go see it, you'll understand why so many people love it and why it's a great American story, why it's a great story of immigration, really ultimately why it's a great love story, and the performances are great. Again, Ronan is fantastic. Emery Cohen is really good. Julie Walters is a scene stealer in this movie. Jim Broadbent is really great. It has a fantastic score and just really powerfully emotional scenes, again, between characters that are just largely likable. And sometimes you just need that from movies, where you just have a wholly positive experience and you see something and you see a story told that just makes you feel good as a moviegoer and as a person. So highly recommend Brooklyn.
Yeah, it's a real mom movie. Or a real big sister movie. No, I like Brooklyn a lot. I recently watched it as well. It's a beautifully put together movie. With what stands out for me is there's this moment where she's helping in a on Christmas, I think, it's not like a homeless shelter, but it's like, you know, they're feeding
like a food
all
kitchen.
These, yeah, food kitchen where they're feeding all of these kind of not homeless guys, but like, you know, really poor workers and stuff, and they're all Irish, and one of them sings this this Irish song, and it's, oh man, it's like,
yeah,
it reminds me of the scene in what is it? Is it Paths of Glory? Where there's like somebody, I think somebody singing and it shows close-ups of all the soldiers' faces, and they're kind of, you can see that they're traveling home in their minds, but it's just this, it's just this great cinematic moment where all you need is human face, and that tells you everything that needs to be told about the scene. It's a really special movie and really well put together. I will say, I'll take this opportunity to bring this up. As somebody that is very picky about child actor performances, there is a child performance in this movie that is, in my opinion, one of the most stone-cold, stunner-worthy things that I saw all year long. And it's blowing me away that it doesn't bother you as much as it apparently doesn't bother you.
It's precocious, for sure, and it's at times a little anachronistic, too, but...
Yeah, maybe.
But,
basically playing a Game Gear in one scene.
Yep, what really works for me about it is how they use it, how they utilize it to tell the story, especially when it comes to the Emery Cohen character, Tony,
yeah.
How he wants to communicate with Ailish, Ronan's character, by writing her a letter. And he shows a lot of humility and acknowledges that he's not a good writer. He doesn't really know how to write. But he knows that it would mean a lot to her for him to put pen to paper and speak to her in that manner. And the fact, you know, I just love the fact that he calls upon his little brother, this kid, this punk kid, who represents the next generation of an educated, the educated generation of their family. And he's able to, again, acknowledge that about himself and use that to his advantage. And I just think that was a beautifully, beautifully rendered moment in the movie.
Yeah, it's definitely set up and paid off nicely. It's just the part where it's the Sandlot, where the Sandlot happens in the movie Brooklyn is – you know, it hit me the wrong way, but you're right. It pays off in a really, really nice moment. And just the last hour of that movie is extremely tense. In its own way, it's close to the tension of Mad Max Fury Road with a fraction of the car chases. So wait, we're on number three, right? So this was this one is one of those that kind of, it is kind of oscillated between a 9 out of 10 and a 10 out of 10. But then I think about a moment early on in the movie, and it just cinches it for me. It's one of the great movies of 2015, and one of my favorites, and that's Ryan Coogler's Creed. Early in the film, there's this moment where basically he's an underprivileged kid that doesn't think he has any family, but when he's confronted with the idea that there's somebody out there for him, that there's a name out there for him, that matters and that can help them find identity. The camera starts on this shot of his closed fist. He's just gotten done getting in a fight. His closed fist, his fist releases and the camera pans over to his face and he asks about the name of his family. And then it cuts to the title card. And that's just an A-plus moment that, you know, man, I'm in the hands of a master filmmaker. And it's insane that the filmmaker happens to be as young as he is, and it's only his second feature film. But yeah, Creed is a great movie. There's so many amazing moments. There's a handful of kind of chintzy, cheesy moments that we talked about in our review of it a few months ago. But overall, it's just a tremendous movie. Awesome score. The performances are fantastic. It is, as much as I love Mark Rylance, there is definitely a part of me that wishes Stallone had gotten an Oscar just for playing that Rocky character as a sympathetic pick. But yeah, Creed is my number three, and it's one of the easily one of the best movies of last year and one of the best movies of the last few years.
Yeah, you know, the real power in that movie really is rooted in the scene you're talking about, and it's there's a moment towards the end of it that calls back to that. And, you know, I think enough people have seen Creed at this point to sort of go in depth on what I feel like is the most important theme of it, and it's this idea of an illegitimate child, right?
Yeah.
And how a nasty designation like illegitimate, you know, that comes before child, the fact that that exists and the fact that that gives a young person, child in this case, such an enormous hurdle as soon as they're born in terms of coming to terms with their own adequacy when it comes to their family and their legacy and what they should live up to, that to me, that is the real strength in Creed. And when I think about that aspect of it, it makes me appreciate it even more, and it makes me understand that that is what Coogler and Michael B. Jordan and company were really going for here in terms of telling this character's story and how you are not illegitimate. You are your own person. You make your own way however you want to do that. And the character of Adonis Creed here, once you consider all of those things, is just, he's one of the characters of the year.
Yeah, yeah, you're not a mistake. You know, that you're right. That is the line of the movie, and it's. I hesitated to spoil it, but you're right. It's you know, obviously people have had the chance to see it, and it's one of the lines of the year for me, and it is the key to the whole film, and it's great because it's when the movie goes from this, you know, really entertaining sports movie that's a sequel and a popcorn film in its own right. It's where it goes from that to being an important movie about social justice. And that's what great blockbuster filmmakers should be doing. You know, that's what Christopher Nolan did with the Dark Knight films. He took this big popular platform and talked about the problems of the world and how we might deal with them. And it's so exciting to me that Ryan Coogler took that chance, you know, took this huge opportunity and made something really special and really personal and really, for lack of a better word, useful, you know, to culture. And I feel like it's a movie that's only gonna improve with more viewings and as more people see it.
Definitely. So my number two is the Best Picture winner, Thomas McCarthy's Spotlight. And
wow.
In the aftermath of the Oscars, I've heard all these people not disappointed that it won, but feeling like they have to justify why Spotlight is great. And I honestly don't understand why you have to make an extra effort to justify why it won Best Picture, why it beat out The Revenant, why it beat out The Big Short, and all those other really good movies. It's pretty plain as day to me. It's a brilliant movie, and it's a tragic story, and there are different ways you could have told this story. I love the fact that they chose to do it from the perspective of journalists who uncovered the cover-up, the just tragic story of these sexually abused children in the Catholic Church in Boston. I mean, there's another movie to be made out there that tells it from those kids' perspective and in the family's perspective. And we certainly get doses of that in this movie, and those scenes are incredibly powerful. But, you know, I'm a journalist, and I love journalism movies, as few of them as we get these days. But it's right up there with the great ones. Obviously, you have everybody sort of launching into the whole, it's the best journalism movie since All the President's Men. And yeah, that's probably true, but let's give it a little bit more credit than that. This is just a deeply human story that needed to be told. And, you know, as journalists, it's hard to, you know, you have to separate yourself, you know, as the storyteller from the content, right? You can't put yourself into that. You have to be objective. You have to tell the story in a way that is invisible. And I can't imagine what those journalists went through in terms of separating themselves from it and not feeling the need or feeling a cause to be a part of, again, uncovering this truth, this horrible truth that exists in the world today, and not really understanding how human beings are capable of doing that and seeing it through those eyes. It, to me, was just as powerful as any set of eyes that could have seen it, because they were sort of the first to see it. And the fact that they had the responsibility to shed light on it and bring it to the eyes of the world is just what a responsibility in ways, what a burden to not only tell the story correctly, but do it in a way that was respectful to those who went through what they went through according to those stories. So I just think Thomas McCarthy and Josh Singer wrote an absolutely brilliant script, and Thomas McCarthy, a guy who has directed several understated movies, just he directs it in such a way that doesn't call attention to itself, but again, there's just no denying the brilliance of this movie, the pace of it, the focus of it. This movie flies by for me, and it's just an absolutely brilliant piece of filmmaking.
Yeah, I mean, not a hair out of place. It's really, really well put together, and I was so happy when it won Best Picture, because I feel like, again, for me, the Oscars aren't necessarily the Best Picture is not necessarily the Best Picture, but I feel like it's the movie that needs to represent, you know, the moment, and I think that Spotlight does that extremely well. There's a really great piece that Matt Singer wrote about the quiet direction of Spotlight. I've seen a few things. There's this video I think that was on Fandor maybe about how it didn't deserve to be nominated because it was filmed in this TV style, which is a criticism that I've leveled against The Big Short. But I think that that Spotlight is a very cinematic movie in the way that it showcases space. You know, geography is so important to this movie, and how close these journalists are to the crimes that happened, and how close that certain, you know, institutions are to one another. I feel like that's all beautifully communicated through camera movements, lens selection, and editing. It's a quietly, brilliantly directed movie, and I'm really happy that it's gotten the respect that it deserves, and I'm happy to see it so high on your list.
Yeah, and I shouldn't go without mentioning the ensemble cast here, which is just phenomenal. And I mean, we can drop the names. I think everybody knows who all's in this movie, but they're great. And you know, to touch a little bit on what you just said, I've heard clowns call this like the best the best HBO movie ever made, right? In terms of leveling that TV criticism at it, I think that's dopey. I think, like you said, it is incredibly cinematic. I mean, I don't really understand like the need to really defend it in that regard. I think people are losing their appreciation for filmmaking, again, understated filmmaking. That doesn't mean that just because it doesn't go as big as some of the movies in terms of scale that you've seen. Sometimes the largeness exists in the character and in the stories and in the moment, like you mentioned before. And you know, there is one big acting scene in the movie that people have complained about, the big blow up from Mark Ruffalo towards the end of the movie. And honestly, in retrospect, that sequence really works for me, because I mean, just consider everything that is bubbling up inside of these reporters who have obviously worked so hard on the reporting, and they're finally arriving at the moment when they finally release this story into the world, into their community where it matters the most. And I can just imagine the pressure that they were feeling on getting it right. And here they are at the moment. And in that moment, he's told it's not quite the right time. And I can just sense being a member of that community and not only feeling the burden and responsibility of telling the story, but also feeling the anger that everybody else who reads that story and hears that it's happening in their backyard, the anger that they're going to feel too. So in retrospect, that scene really works for me, and the whole movie is just spectacular.
Yeah, performances are just incredible. I think part of what might rub me the wrong way about the Ruffalo thing is the fact that there are two other supporting performances in that movie, in Liev Schreiber and Stanley Tucci, that I feel like are so good in the same way that the film is good, in like a very quiet, reserved way. And I think that it's kind of like, well, of course they, you know, nominated the one that has the blow up. Yeah, but that shouldn't take anything away from Ruffalo. But I do think that Schreiber and Tucci and also Keaton are just
Keaton, man,
magnetic in that movie.
Yep.
Right, so going from very low key directing to, in my opinion, the most audacious and just swaggering directing of the year by the King of the Mountain, Bridge of Spies. We already talked about it. Like I said, it's a movie that you can, you even though it's got crackling dialogue and incredibly well paced screenplay, you can turn it on mute and still know exactly what's going on in every single scene. From the opening shot of this movie, it's pure storytelling. So the opening shot is a close-up of Mark Rylance leaning into a mirror. Camera moves back and really and kind of shows that it's an over-the-shoulder of him that splits the frame between his reflection in a mirror and a painting that he's making of himself. And that motif comes back throughout the rest of the movie and actually is reflected in the final shot of the movie. And it's all about how do we perceive ourselves, you know, not just as individuals, but as a nation, you know, and how do we express our identity to the world around us? It's one of the many themes going on in the movie, and it's, again, beautifully represented in that opening shot, and it's, you know, one of the ways that I look at all of these movies is, all right, so whatever's happening in the middle, how does it open and how does it close? You know, I feel like that's one of the most important things about a movie, opening and closing shot. And there's it's hard to find a movie this year that had a more beautifully bookended sequence of images. The end of the movie also has this really great sequence that recalls the horrors that the Tom Hanks character saw in East Berlin. Throughout the movie, it's just incredible set pieces and storytelling. It's a movie that that when I first saw it, I was like, that's good, Spielberg. And the more I thought about it, the more I considered it highly, and the more I looked at bits and pieces of it. It's marvelously crafted. It's really hard to find a whole lot wrong with it. Other than the superficial things we mentioned earlier, just that it's just not a great cultural fit, although, again, if you look closely at it, it is an incredible fit for, especially right now, our you know, when so much of the country is willing to respond at the voting booths because out of fear and anger. This is a movie that says, right, when you feel fear and anger, don't throw out the rule book, you know, don't throw out the Constitution, don't throw out the thing that makes us who we are, and the thing that we use to define ourselves. So it's a masterful movie. It's another of these classic movies of Steven Spielberg's that he's been making, where he addresses nationalism, like you mentioned, Lincoln, also Munich. I think War Horse has a lot to say about, you know, serving the nation state and war and borders and all these things. So, yeah, obviously I can go on and on and on about Bridge of Spies, but it's a movie that's not just is it one of the great movies of 2015. It's a movie that's weaseled its way into my top 10 Steven Spielberg movies of all time. And at this point in his career, it is staggering that he's still doing that, you know, that he's still making movies that are sitting up there with the movies that he was making in the mid-70s and the 80s and in the early 90s. So, yeah, so it's just another day of me talking about how great Bridge of Spies is.
Yeah, I don't know how you got all that just by seeing a dude standing in front of a mirror. I don't know.
Right, yeah, that's not what movies do all the time. Juxtaposition of images means nothing. But how about those zooms in The Big Short, though?
That's not what we're here to do, Spark.
She was in a bathtub. LOL.
Okay. Let's go to number one. How about that?
All right, number one.
Okay, so I just watched the last third of this movie on cable today. It just, like, premiered on cable last week. So the fact that it's going to be playing pretty much around the clock for the next couple of weeks means I'm in big trouble. Or the way I look at it, I'm in for a treat, you know, pretty much every day because I'm going to get stuck watching it. And for me, I mean, movies typically all come down to a couple of things, storytelling, and perhaps most important these days, the lost art of imagination. right? And to me, I'm going to bookend my list here, obviously, with Pixar movies. And Inside Out, to me, is the most imaginative piece of filmmaking of 2015 for a variety of reasons. But I just want to first celebrate the fact that we got two great Pixar movies in 1 year, and we don't deserve it, honestly. And
no.
You know, clearly, I think Inside Out is the superior film between the two, but it seriously feels like you're judging kids and children and siblings, you know, and parents when it comes to picking your favorite Pixar movies and deciding on which one was better. It doesn't really matter. They're all great. And Inside Out falls in line with Pixar masterpieces and just the fact that you can not only, I mean, people joked about this movie back when it first came out, like, oh, you mean like Pixar's making Herman's Head the movie, right? It's like, well, Herman's Head had a great idea. It just happened to be a cheap sitcom, you know? Like, that we're just talking about, you know, mediums here and the way you tell a story, but, you know, you could give Pixar the plot for pretty much every terrible movie, and I'm sure that they would conjure up something pretty noteworthy. So in the case of Inside Out, going into the mind of a young girl and basically communicating to young people and to people our age and even older that as a child or as an adult, it's okay to be sad. And that is, I think, the largest theme that Pete Docter and company are trying to help people understand, especially young people struggling with their emotions growing up who don't really understand what sadness is, what depression may even be, and how they don't always have to be happy all the time. And on the surface, that doesn't sound like Toy Story, right? That doesn't sound as fun as Finding Nemo, but there's an inherent sadness in most of the Pixar movies. I mean, that's why they're so emotional, and that's why people cry watching Pixar movies. And I think that's why people pretty much cried from beginning to end with Inside Out, because it just tapped into something that people had never seen on the big screen or in movies before emotionally. And you talk about Steven Spielberg at this point in his career. How is it possible that he made one of the best movies he ever made or a top 10 movie of his respective filmography? The same can be said of Pixar, even though it's only been making movies since 1995. I mean, as much as it's accomplished already, how is it possible Pixar, after Cars 2 in this new era of Pixar where they're making sequels and revisiting characters the way that they are, how is it possible that they delivered something so fresh, so original, and so deeply, richly human and emotional this late in the game, in the studio's young existence? It blows my mind, but I laughed my tail off watching this. And just a few hours ago, as I was watching it with my wife and our baby daughter, I welled up like my baby daughter. and it just connects. And again, I mean, it goes places that you didn't really think movies could go, and it certainly has the advantage of being an animated movie and being able to do what, you know, physically what live action perhaps can't do, and certainly that's, you know, more and more is possible these days with certain advances, but this movie should only have existed, or the story should only have existed in the animated format. And Pete Docter is just obviously a special filmmaker, and he puts his heart into every movie that he makes, and he is such a huge part of what makes Pixar so special. And I find myself again thinking about Inside Out more than any movie in 2015, and I will watch this movie forever.
Yeah, it's my number one as well. Not hard to predict. I mean, talk about opening shots. Oh man, there's so many images in this movie that are so beautifully composed. But what it all comes down to is what you mentioned earlier: the imagination and the ability of Pete Docter and his team to take a great idea and not leave it at that, but to wring every potentiality out of that idea, you know, and to really explore every corner of it, and to in the process give, I mean, it, again, it's kind of like the Creed thing. Like, I don't want to boil movies down to being utilities, but at the same time, there's a utility to this movie. You know, it forever from now on, kids are going to be able to communicate to their parents, to the people around them, what they're feeling and, you know, why they're feeling it and why that's not a scary thing. You know, why we don't have to listen, why we don't have to, you know, change our reality based on the what's going on in our mind or our heart at a given moment. You know, why that doesn't have to change our entire existence. And I feel like that's a really healthy thing to explore, and the difference between sadness and depression and the, again, just the utility of emotion and contextualizing it and giving us all, I mean, even as adults, you know, giving us a tool to talk about what we're feeling, how we're human, connecting us. It's hard to talk about this movie because it's both so cerebral and emotional and artistically engaging. And, you know, what else can you ask of your movies? You know, it's a movie that not only does it all do all these things with psychology and with emotion, with storytelling, with character, but it also finds a way to explore the history of animation, you know, and all these different art styles that come out once the film delves into the subconscious and all these different parts of the mind. And it looks at movies, and it compares movies to dreams the way that so many great filmmakers have done before. It's just a masterpiece, and the second I walked out of it, I was like, well, I think it's all going to be downhill from here and for the rest of the year. And I mean, I guess if it's my number one, it kind of was, but it ended up being an incredible year, and you know, it's all nicely represented by this masterpiece of a movie.
Yeah, and like you said, I mean, the fact that it can serve an even greater purpose than being a great movie, that it can help young people, children even, I mean, before you ever thought they could even think of these concepts and these very specific things about themselves, the fact that it can help them express those things outwardly in a way that perhaps they couldn't before they saw the movie means that they should probably go ahead and preserve this somehow nationally in the National Film Registry.
Yeah, well, it should get like the Nobel Prize.
Yeah, for sure. You know, and like you said, I mean, things. This movie, unto itself, it's like one. It's one giant intelligent concept. It's just, in fact, it's a bunch of them, right? I mean, you mentioned like the train of thought. You mentioned abstract thought when they explore all those different styles of art. You have the emotions themselves. I mean, our friend Matt Scalici, obviously with Film Nerds here, he mentioned to us that when his daughter saw the movie, who I believe is 7 or 8 years old, her big question after seeing the movie was, do the emotions have emotions? How does that work? You know, and the fact that it can basically inspire that kind of thinking out of young and old people, it's just a miraculous accomplishment. And I mean, who other than Pixar did we expect it from, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, I mean, so great movie. I think, honestly, man, this is probably the strongest movie year I have on my list since 2011 or so, when we got Tree of Life and Take Shelter and a handful of other great movies in 1 year. It may top that year. I think 2015, it may not be the most well-rounded in terms of, you know, all sorts of different types of movies, but I think from a Hollywood perspective, I think that Hollywood released, I mean, just looking at my top five, you've got Star Wars, Mad Max, and a Rocky movie, and a Pixar movie. I think Hollywood really did their part and made some really great, special mainstream movies. And that's something, you know, that doesn't happen very often. So for me, 2015 was a really great year.
Definitely. And before we're done here, you want to go into just a handful of honorable mentions?
Yeah, real quick. Let's go through those. What are yours?
Okay, I'm just going to run through the next 10 that I have. And I mentioned the Kurt Cobain documentary, Montage of Heck. Really terrific. Highly recommend it to people. Mission Impossible, Rogue Nation, The Martian, Sicario, While We're Young, Ex Machina, Room, Tangerine, the Michael Mann movie Black Hat, super underrated, and then Beasts of No Nation at number 20 for me.
Yeah, so mine are basically what was on my top 10 were like 9 out of 10s, 10s out of 10 out of 10s. And so what's on my list is basically all my 8 out of 10s. I mentioned The Nightmare and Look of Silence. I just watched Carol recently, and that is a fantastic movie. Avengers Age of Ultron, Spotlight, The Hateful Eight, The Revenant, Crimson Peak, The Man from U.N.C.L.E., which is a pretty underrated, really fun little movie. I mentioned Finders Keepers earlier, Spectre, and The Good Dinosaur. So, again, a really good collection of both independent, but a lot of pretty solid Hollywood fare, too. And those were in no particular order, but it was a tough year to make my top 10. So sounds like it was for you too.
Absolutely. I consider 2015 a great year. You know, honestly, I think most years are pretty great, but
yeah,
I struggled to put a top 30 together, you know, and try to piece it together and order it in a certain way. And there's still a handful of things I need to see. You know, I just caught up with a few movies on Netflix and on cable. So I watched Jafar Pahani's Taxi, which is really good and is on Netflix now. Tangerine is on Netflix. You saw
Tangerine is definitely on my honorable mentions as well.
You saw a foreign film called Phoenix, which I think is still on Netflix. Look of Silence is on
very
there.
Good.
So there are a bunch of 2015 movies that are readily available if you're obviously a Netflix subscriber, but are out there on Redbox and out there playing on different cable channels. So I really implore people to catch up on 2015. It just had so much to offer, and you know, beyond these top tens that we just shared with you, it really was a rich experience from January to December.
I agree. Yeah. So thanks again for talking to me about the year, and I really think your number one pick is on point.
Yeah, you too, man. Now it's time for my brother, Grant Flanagan, up in New York, to share his favorite movies from the last film year. And it's March, but we're finally caught up. The Oscars are just in our rearview mirrors, and so it's time to finally close the door on the film year. So, Graham, I'm going to toss it to you, but first, just tell me a little bit about your overall feelings of 2015. Was it a great year? Was it a so-so year? How did it stack up to film years of recent memory?
I think it was a great year for sure. It's hard to make a top 10 list because there's so many movies on that I couldn't fit on the list that I loved. So whenever that happens, you know it's a great year. When you can have at least 10 experiences that are great cinematic experiences, I think that's a good year. And when you have so many that it's hard to fill out a list of just 10, for me, that makes 2015 just an incredible year for movies. And I had very few disappointments, but I will start off just by saying that my most disappointing and one of the only real disappointments of the year was Aloha, the Cameron Crowe movie. I'm not sure what the purpose of that exercise was. And it's a shame that Cameron Crowe has fallen to this point. He's one of my favorite filmmakers, especially from his early work in the 80s and 90s. And I really hope that he can come back. And, you know, I think he's got a lot of people scratching their heads. For me, he's been in a slump. And this is my own subjective opinion, obviously, but he's been in a slump ever since Almost Famous. And I have not seen We Bought a Zoo, but all of his efforts since then have really let me down. So that being said, there were a lot of amazing films this year, and I'll start with number 10, which was Creed. Just a fantastic film, a great Rocky film, and actually I missed this in the theater, was able to see it on demand recently, and just absolutely loved it.
So it kind of snuck up on you. You saw it later than a lot of the movies that probably occupied this list. I'm guessing that it was the most recent addition to your top 10, huh?
Oh, definitely. Absolutely. If I look at the list, it's definitely the movie I saw most recently. And I heard nothing but great things about it. So went in with pretty high expectations. And I just thought it delivered, and I can't wait to see what Coogler, the director, does again after this to follow it up. And I still have yet to see Fruitvale Station, so I'm pumped to check that out. But I loved Creed. Number nine is Brooklyn, which it's just a wonderful movie, and that includes one of my favorite performances of the year, which is Julie Waters, who runs the boarding house. It's a lovely story, powerful story. All around great performances, great period detail, a wonderful screenplay. It's just a wonderful movie that I cannot wait to revisit. Number eight is Steve Jobs. I cannot understand the backlash against this film, even though it got some love in award season. It's confounding to me. I just thought that overall this movie should have won Best Editing. The fact that it didn't get a screenplay nomination is just insane to me. I love Steve Jobs.
Yeah, I love Steve Jobs too. It's on my top 10 list, and I agree. If there is any backlash, it is confounding, and it's at least good to know that critics seem to mostly like it a lot, and it did get some awards consideration. Obviously, the acting categories. I think this is a movie that should have been in the Best Picture conversation. Like you said, should have been in the screenplay without any doubt whatsoever. And also, Danny Boyle just doing some great work, some of his best work in a few movies. So, Steve Jobs, it's up there for me too, and I can't wait to watch it again. I've still only seen it the one time.
Number seven is Mad Max Fury Road, which hung around on the list. I think it came out in the early summer, right, like May. That one hung around for a long time, and it's gotten, you know, a ton of positive, reactions, and justifiably so. It's a great story. It's a unique story in terms of the world of action and sci-fi, and that it's sort of about women. Even though Mad Max is the movie holds his name, it's really about this group of women fighting back. So a very unique story there. And so much has been said about just the design of the world that George Miller created. Fortunately, it won a ton of Oscars honoring that originality, and I can't wait to just continue to revisit it. Thank you for getting me the Blu-ray for Christmas.
You're welcome.
Number six is Joy, which is another film that has created a ton of negative backlash, which is just perplexing to me. I just thought this movie was we did a whole podcast about it for FNU, but just such a strong, powerful film, you know, and great performances. And I think David O. Russell proves here that he is the real deal. He's proven it before, but I mean, with this, after capping off his recent run with this one, it's just he's getting better and better with every movie. And even today, a former colleague and a friend of mine responded on Twitter saying that she thought Joy was just terrible. And I just don't understand what the mindset is of these people when they go and see this film, which is just so positive and uplifting and encouraging to people.
Yeah, it makes way less sense to me than the Steve Jobs backlash that you may have mentioned, even though I don't know how much existed for that. But, yeah, the majority of people I see on Twitter, in person, whatever, consider this a really bad movie, like a stinker even. And it just kind of makes me sad that people don't see what I think we see here with this movie, just in that it is very powerful and it tells a great crowd-pleasing story. I don't know if it's that people are sick of David O. Russell and Jennifer Lawrence's collaborations, even though they love those last two movies pretty much overall. For me, this is the best of those movies, personally, and I just feel sorry for people who, for whatever reason, walk in or out of it with that opinion, because it's one of the best movies of the year, and it's one of the best movies of David O. Russell and Jennifer Lawrence's career.
Absolutely. Number five, speaking of veteran auteurs continuing their momentum, The Hateful Eight, Quentin Tarantino's film. I've only seen this once, cannot wait to see it again. It was so incredible that he created this world. He continues to dig into the Western genre putting his unique spin on it. You know, I'm a big fan of Django Unchained, which you know, some have called a Southern as opposed to a Western, but here he just creates such rich characters. He incorporates that violence and brutality that, you know, is a signature of Tarantino's from all his other films, combines that, you know, identity with the identity of the Western. And then in terms of the production design and the look and feel of it, the music by Ennio Morricone, it really delivered for me.
That's interesting. And the whole Southern Western thing, it's anybody who calls it a Southern is just doing so to be cute, just in terms of where the movie takes place for the most part. It's got cowboys, it's got horses, it's got six shooters. It's a freaking Western, so people can get over it. And yeah, Hateful Eight probably fits the bill just in terms of the geography. But Graham, just quickly, since we're sizing up the year, size up where the Hateful Eight falls in your preference among Tarantino films.
It's a good question. I mean, I feel like for me, Pulp Fiction and Reservoir Dogs just sort of occupy the top one or two spots. Interchangeably. And then after that, you know, I would definitely rank Hateful Eight over Inglourious Basterds. I would go ahead and rank it over Django. I mean, I love both of those films. Right now, Hateful Eight is just, it's hot for me in my mind. I would put it up there with Kill Bill Volume 1. I mean, these are just all great films. And for me, that, you know, they all sort of stand together as part of his whole body of work. There's nothing about Hateful Eight that I disliked or was frustrated about. So, you know, I would sort of, since Pulp Fiction and Reservoir Dogs sort of defined who Tarantino is, and those movies just continue to get better with age, I'm not going to say it's going to get close to that, but, you know, definitely need to see it again. I will continue to watch Kill Bill Volume 1 over and over again. I love Django Unchained. Just saw that recently, and I love Inglourious Basterds, so definitely in the conversation with all those post-Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction.
What was your favorite performance in The Hateful Eight?
I would say overall my favorite performance was Samuel L. Jackson. I think it was a shame he didn't get nominated for an Oscar. Behind that, Kurt Russell, man, that stagecoach scene at the beginning is just gold, and I can't wait to go back and watch that again. Their interplay, their delivery, and their voices, respectively, were just in the heart and soul of that movie. So number four, the quote-unquote TV movie Beasts of No Nation, which failed to score any Oscar nominations, you know, inexplicably. To me, this has the, you know, two of the best performances of the year between Idris Elba and Abraham Atta, the young man in the film who just got robbed of an Oscar nomination. Cary Fukunaga, who everybody, you know, lauded so much for his True Detective Season 1 work, shows that he is just a brilliant filmmaker, able to work in any medium, it, you know, TV, miniseries, or narrative feature. Just on every level, this movie, to me, is a masterpiece. Hard to watch at times, but it definitely gave me that same feeling that I got watching City of God, one of the great movies of the last couple of decades. And, you know, it's just funny to me that so many people, even though this movie had all the, you know, it had on paper checked all these boxes in terms of actors involved and technical aspects and storyline, that people still just kind of, you know, ignored it, calling it a made-for-TV movie because it was distributed on Netflix, and instead of embracing it as a, you know, a narrative film that's just being released on the new platform. That was ridiculous, and I think if that hadn't happened and people would have given it a chance earlier on, it would have had the momentum necessary to bring it to the Oscars, and who knows how the race would have turned out. But this film, to me, is just great on so many levels. It needs to be seen.
Yeah, and it's right there, right? So many Netflix subscribers just have it right there, and they can watch it right now, and they should. And I only saw it just recently, and going back to the snubs you mentioned, the one that obviously makes the least amount of sense is Idris Elba, who obviously won SAG and won BAFTA. I don't know if those were makeup calls. I don't think so, because it's just an electrifying performance. I mean, it's just him
just hitting on all cylinders, and he's phenomenal. And like you said, the real true story here is Abraham Mattah. And I think that there's some legitimacy to the criticism of it being sort of brutal for the sake of being brutal in parts, but I don't think the movie ever loses focus or doesn't have its eye on the ball, which is telling this young man's just tragic story in the midst of the Civil War. And that is all driven home by just the looks on Abraham Mattah's face. And it's just amazing that not only a boy could act that way, but I mean, you think of child performances, there are great child performances we can recall, but you have to consider also his physical surroundings and the things, the actual content and the subject matter that are happening around the kid who is obviously probably not been exposed to things of that nature. So to me, that's what puts the performance on an even greater level than other great child performances.
And you know, it's easy to forget the first sort of like 15 minutes of the film because you get sucked into this black hole of horror and just, you know, basically you're in hell for the next 2 hours or so. But the first 15 minutes or so of the movie are so sweet and how they set up the loving home life that this kid has. And, you know, throughout the film, I found myself like remembering what he had and how sad it was that it was all taken away for no reason. That's just one of my favorite aspects of the film that made it, you know, mean so much when you realize how much had been taken away from him and how he'd been willing to survive to get to hopefully return to some semblance of normal life. It's just such a great story. It's an epic and, hopefully people will see it. Number three. And now with the top three, any of these could sort of be interchanged for my favorite film of the year. It's difficult to do this. But number three is Big Short, which for some reason, the people, a lot of the guys that do this these podcasts, FNU, just failed to embrace, even though they preface every negative statement about it, saying, oh, now here's the thing. It's good, but here are all the reasons it sucks and I hate it. I hope that you guys give it another chance. To me, this movie is so well-made, so funny, so smart, so entertaining. You know, I've watched it multiple times, and it gets better every time. All the performances are incredible. And it just shows that Adam McKay is a real filmmaker. He transcends his own comedy background with this, and I can't wait to see what he does next, even though he said he will make more Will Ferrell, John C. Reilly movies. But, man, kudos to him for showing that he really is a legit filmmaker, you know, that's able to try new things outside of the realm in which he'd become so comfortable. So this movie had such a strong reaction when I first watched it and can't wait to see it again and again and again. So well made, so creative. And it just baffles me why you guys had such a, you know, it's like you guys called out all these people that were snarky on The Revenant. Well, you're doing the same thing about this movie, which there's no reason anyone should hate on it other than reasons which are not very clear still to this day.
Now, the difference is the people who hate on The Revenant flat out just call it trash, which makes zero sense. Ben Stark, who you're also leveling this criticism towards, he and I both like the movie. We like the movie. We just haven't embraced it as much as you have. And that's okay, you know? Like, we don't both have to have it number three in our top ten list. There are more movies out there, and we happen to like other movies more than The Big Short, but we like The Big Short.
That's an LOL right there.
There's no smarter moment in movies in 2015, though, when there's a graphic illustrating a dude bragging about some testicular procedure he went through.
You guys, it's okay. Y'all should. I just wish that you could go one way or another and quit, you know, all this.
That was the most courageous moment of 2015, I think.
See, that's ridiculous. And people said the same thing about The Revenant with little aspects of that film that, you know. So
I'm talking about a specific moment. Mm-hmm. I'm not just leveling blind hate towards it without any examples. I mean, there are just things in it. And you know, I think it's, you know, I feel bad. Look, I take responsibility for engaging in the unhealthy practice of comparing one movie towards another or having a reactionary opinion based on the level of adoration people have for a movie I don't like as much as them, but unfortunately that's just what it's come to.
Yeah, well, hopefully you guys can check.
It's a great pick, though. It's a great pick.
Thank you. Number two, I know you guys might think this is a little controversial, but I'm going to put the Pixar double feature from 2015, Inside Out and The Good Dinosaur. Now, while I would rank Inside Out much higher than Good Dinosaur, Good Dinosaur is a masterpiece on its own, and Inside Out is one of the best movies, maybe the best movie Pixar's ever made. And, you know, it's been around since the summer. We've talked a lot about it. It truly is special and moving and, you know, it's totally unique and creative. And I got to say, The Good Dinosaur affected me in, you know, a comparable way. It is also a work of art in terms of its animation and its setting and design, but also its story is just so simple. You know, very little, it's different from Inside Out in that this is told with a lot more visual storytelling, you know, where there's not a lot of dialogue. Both of these movies are just so powerful. And, you know, I know Pixar's got a lot of sequels coming down the pike, and which I'm sure, you know, I'm going to give them a chance and can't wait to see the new Finding Nemo film. But, man, in 2015, they made two original films that are just fantastic. And hopefully more people, I love our jokes about how The Good Dinosaur must suck because nobody really talks about it, even though it's going to be huge in the children's market going forward with home video. It's a masterpiece, and I hope more people give it a chance. And I mean, we've said enough about Inside Out, I think, and we all agree that it is a truly special masterpiece, but man, you got to give it to Pixar for releasing just two wonderful original films in 2015.
I'm with you on both of them, including The Good Dinosaur, and a lot of the movies you've mentioned so far, like Steve Jobs and Joy and now The Good Dinosaur, it's like this has, there's a longer list of underrated movies from 2015 than I think that has been my experience, you know, in recent memory. And I just wonder, you know, it just makes me wonder about people in movies now and how they choose to watch them, experience them, engage about them, and what I might be missing, you know, that they're seeing about these movies that you know, make their experience so negative. And I guess it's just like it's fun to be negative about things, but, I, you know, maybe it is. Maybe it's fun to, you know, tweet negative things about what people are wearing at the Grammys or about food or, you know, bad food. I just don't understand it when it comes to these kinds of movies, like why people get the kind of satisfaction, you know, the film, it's an FNU episode unto itself, why people get the kind of satisfaction they do in terms of just like, you know, these empty trashings of just, to me, beautiful works of art. It just makes no sense.
Well, yeah, and you'll see that a lot from Corey Kraft, who's a friend of the show. Go back and look through his Twitter feed. It's there. Then I have a former colleague from Business Insider, Brett Arnold, who's like, I think Brett Redacted on Twitter. You know, and these guys, they're smart about movies. They know a lot about movies. They see everything. They know a lot about film history. And they just go off on these negative tirades of things. And I feel sorry for them, honestly, because I think they're more interested in what they're saying than what they're actually seeing. And it's, you know, people just need to continue to engage and, you know, and call them out, and hopefully maybe we'll see less of it, and maybe they'll sort of realize that they should give art, they should look at this art in a different way without all these politics and external factors in terms of box office and how they're perceived and who's involved in them, and just kind of listen to their own hearts and in terms of how they react, because there are a lot of people out there that will go buy a tweet or a snarky review, and they'll say, okay, well, I guess I don't need to see Big Short or Good Dinosaur or Revenant because this person, you know, made this funny comment about it. And that's really unfortunate because that can really impact somebody's choice. So hopefully we'll see less of that. And that brings me to my final film of the year, number one for me, my number one favorite film of 2015, Chappie by Neil Blomkamp. So much hatred towards this film, so much snark, so much negative criticism, and it's just mind-blowing to me. I don't know if it's just the title, the concept of the film. It's just unbelievable to me. This film is perfect. It's revolutionary in terms of its technology. Its story is beautiful. The performances are incredible. It's so original. It's just a marvel in so many ways.
Yeah, so it went wire to wire for you, huh? I mean, was that the first great movie you saw of 2015, and it held firm?
Well, it rotated a little bit. Like I had Inside Out number one, I had Big Short number one, so it definitely, you know, fluctuated a little bit. But then I watched it again at the end of the year, and it's just, you know, it's as great, if not better, than I remembered it being when I first saw it back in like March or February of 2015. So it's just unbelievable. It's a special piece, and you know, I don't even want to acknowledge all the hate I already did, but it's just, you know, you gotta rise above that. And you know, the movie stands on its own, and I'll sit down with anybody and watch it, and you know, and just ask them, like, so what about this is bad? What about this is silly? You know, this is actually better special effects than you're going to see in Ex Machina and in Star Wars, The Force Awakens, with a, you know, an even more powerful story from beginning to end. And it's just sad that so many people didn't give it a chance, or gave it a chance and then just crapped all over it. But, you know, I'm just going to continue to try and recommend it to people. Hopefully more people will see it. And I can't wait. And hopefully Neil Blomkamp can rise above it.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting you mentioned Ex Machina and Star Wars, because this movie has the quiet subtlety and story-specific special effects that Ex Machina has, and it has the big, bombastic, action-slanted special effects that you see in something like Star Wars, and it's a blockbuster and it's an art film sort of mixed in one, but mostly it's a really compelling story about family and raising children and just humanity. And I think it's Neil Blomkamp's best movie. And I loved it the moment I saw it. You know, the text thread let you guys know, like, this is great, check it out. Some listened and saw it, some didn't. But, I think that's just the way it is now today. I mean, people have time to see, you know, however many movies they can, but Chappie was one all year that, you know, I'm glad that some people within this group championed, because it deserves it. And yeah, I'm with you. It's one of the best of the year for sure.
Well, I look forward to seeing where it ends up on your list and maybe the list of some of the other Film Nerds crew. And with that, I think that list shows you that, you know, there are a lot of things that we didn't bring up or talk about specifically, and that just proves that it was a fantastic year. And hopefully 2016, already in 2016, I've seen two amazing films that are definitely at the top of my top 10 list, those being Deadpool and Hail Caesar. So, and I know there's a lot more to come, even in the next few weeks. So it's already just shaping up to be a fantastic movie year.
Absolutely. And before we go, Graham, can you just share like one or two or three honorable mentions that like barely missed the top 10?
I would say the main one is Star Wars, The Force Awakens, which I can't wait to you know, see again and again and again. I'm going to buy it when it comes out so I can just enjoy it. That's the main one that if I had a top 11, I would put that on there. And there were a lot more. Still some stuff I haven't seen. I haven't seen Danish Girl. Never got to see that. Room was awesome. Irrational Man, the Woody Allen film. So there were a lot of movies that came out that I really enjoyed that just didn't make this 10 list.
Yeah, you know, I think my biggest regret of 2015, quite honestly, is that I only saw Star Wars once in the theater.
Yeah.
There was so much else. And obviously there's a lot going on personally, but I really anticipated seeing it a lot, like at least three times or so, just because, I mean, in my lifetime, that's what I'd love to do with movies like it. And I only saw it once somehow, and I loved it the one time I saw it. And the only time I ever came close to sniffing seeing it again in the theater, you and I went and saw something at our local theater. And at the end of it, we walked into the theater for Force Awakens just to see what part it was on. And we just kind of stood there for like five straight minutes just marveling at the awesomeness of Force Awakens. And it just really hurts when I think, like, I'm not going to see that on the big screen again for a long time.
I have a feeling that it's going to get re-released theatrically.
At some point.
Yeah, but it's still playing in many theaters up here, so come see me.
Oh, sure. I will. All right. Well, cool. Well, thanks, Graham. I'm glad you liked the movies in 2015.
You got it.
For more from the Film Nerds, go to filmnerds.com.